at 1904 East Main Street in Urbana. Online at quaker.org/urbana.
This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
Good evening. You're listening to Keeping the Faith on WILL. I'm Carly Nix, sitting in for Steve Shoemaker. We have a very exciting show planned for you this week on Mormons and anti-Mormon sentiment in America. Our guest is Christine Hutchinson-Jones, a PhD candidate at Boston University in Religious and Theological Studies. Her specialty is American Religious History, and her dissertation is titled Defining America, Reviling and Revering the Mormons, 1890 to 2008. We are a call-in show, so if you have any questions or comments, you can give us a call at 1-800-222-9455 or locally at 333-9455. Christine, are you there?
I am.
Hello, thank you for being our guest this week.
Well, thank you for inviting me, Carly.
So let's just start out with a brief summary of the Mormon Church, if you don't mind. Or better yet, let's start out with defining the word Mormon and talking about how people use the word Mormon.
Okay, Mormon was actually originally a term used by those outside of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, which is the technical term for the institution, and members of the church actually prefer to go by the term saints. That's how they refer to one another. The term Mormon was drawn from the Book of Mormon, which is an additional scripture that the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints holds sacred that was located and translated by the prophet Joseph Smith in the years, the late 1820s. So outsiders initially would not recognize the church by calling members saints, and so started calling them Mormons. Because the term has become such a popular reference, and that's how most people recognize members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the church now acknowledges the term, but they still prefer amongst themselves to go by saint.
Okay, and the beginnings of anti-Mormon sentiment started happening quite soon after the beginnings of the church. So can you just tell us how that sort of happened?
Well, sure. The church was initially founded in 1830 by the first prophet, Joseph Smith, who was born in Sharon, Vermont, and moved to upstate New York as a child with his family. And it was in upstate New York that most of the early foundings of the church happened. In 1827, Joseph was led by an angel Moroni, as he reported it, to some buried golden plates on the hill Cumorah in upstate New York. He then dug up these plates, took them home, translated them with the aid of some seer stones that he also found with the plates, and the translation became the Book of Mormon, which the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, as I said, regards as scripture in addition to the Hebrew Bible and Christian New Testament. And the additional scripture was what initially drew attackers. They were extremely disturbed by the idea that there was ongoing revelation, that this man was claiming to be in direct contact with God and delivering new revelation, both through the scripture and then in ongoing revelation throughout the rest of his lifetime. So critics of the church did not approve of ongoing revelation, and initial attacks were directed specifically at the Book of Mormon. In 1834, a man by the name of Abra D. Howe actually published the first anti-Mormon text only 4 years after the church was founded. It was called Mormonism Unveiled, and he spent most of the text unpacking the Book of Mormon itself and trying to point it out as, basically preposterous was his claim.
And how has the rhetoric of the anti-Mormon sentiments changed since the original sort of complaints?
Well, with the addition of what the Latter-day Saints referred to as the principle of celestial marriage to the church's practices in the 1830s or 40s, the date isn't quite clear. This is popularly known as polygamy, of course. that became the focus for a lot of anti-Mormon discussion, and also the position of the prophet in the church. The prophet is also the president of the church, and this dates back to Joseph Smith, and there was a lot of concern about the control that the prophet exercised, not only religiously and theologically, but also politically and economically over members. And really, those are concerns that are still ongoing in American culture. There's, you know, we sort of rediscover polygamy every few years, even though the mainline Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints abandoned the practice in the late 19th and early 20th century. There are still some very small groups calling themselves fundamentalist Latter-day Saints who practice polygamy, and every few years the media rediscovers them and reports on them, and we have an incident like was recently in the news down in Texas because a group of fundamentalist Latter-day Saints was accused of child abuse, specifically because of the practice of marrying very young women to older men. And also concerns about the social, economic, and political control that the church hierarchy exercises over the membership are constantly in the news. And we're very much in the forefront of questions about Mitt Romney's candidacy for president during the last few years. So although some of the issues, the specific concerns change, the themes are kind of ongoing.
How has the idea of political control changed from the beginning of the Mormon church to the way it is now?
Well, not all that much, really. In the 19th century, the Latter-day Saints actually founded Utah, which they called Deseret when they initially settled it in the 1840s, because they had been successively run out of several states within the United States territory. When they got to the Intermountain West, it was actually not part of U.S. territory, and they had gone that far afield because they were violently pushed out of successively New York, Pennsylvania, Ohio, two different locations in Missouri, and finally Illinois, where the prophet Joseph Smith was murdered in 1844. And so Brigham Young led the Saints west, and he was not, once Utah became a United States territory, Young was not only the president and prophet of the church, he was also the governor of the territory of Utah. Now, he had been duly elected, but the concern from outside the church was, of course, that if members of the church believed that he was God's prophet, well, why wouldn't they elect him, and why, you know, couldn't he just say, God said you should make me your governor? So there was this idea that the prophet was using what the members believed to be his direct connection to God to manipulate the political actions of members of the church. And although leaders of the church no longer participate directly in politics, and in fact the church had a political party in the 19th century, which was disbanded in the 1890s, and in fact the church now encourages members to join one of the national political parties of their choosing and to vote based on their own conscience, there are still questions about whether or not members are truly independent in their political thought and behavior. So there were questions raised about Mitt Romney and his relationship to the church hierarchy as to whether, you know, if the church president and prophet said, you must do X, would Mitt Romney do X even if it was not in the best interest of the country? And these are questions that were similar to accusations that John F. Kennedy faced when he was running for president in 1960. So it's now more of a question not of the active participation of church leaders themselves in politics, but of church leaders' influence over their members, both as voters and as political candidates.
And do you think that the rhetoric of anti-Mormon sentiment has changed much since the 1830s?
Well, I think it's definitely toned down. It was much more aggressive in the 19th century, as were the actions of Americans reacting against the church. There was violent, very violent anti-Mormonism in the 19th century. The Mormons suffered more religiously motivated violence against them as a group, arguably, than any other religious community in the history of the United States. And that is not the case in the 20th and 21st century, obviously. But in terms of, you know, as I said, the concerns that get raised time and time again, you know, polygamy is still an issue, in spite of the fact that the mainline Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints abandoned the practice in the late 19th century. And, in fact, the Church is very zealous about keeping polygamy at bay, as it were, and monitoring polygamous groups. Also, there are these ongoing accusations of political and social control on the part of the religious hierarchy and the institution over members, in spite of the fact that the Church routinely, from the 19th century forward, has clearly stated, you know, we are not telling our members what to do. And in fact, during Mitt Romney's campaign for the president, they came out with yet another statement of the political neutrality of the Church. So the rhetoric has been toned down, the violence is almost completely eliminated, and yet the concerns that get raised are very much the same.
You're listening to Keeping the Faith on WILL. If you would like to call and ask a question or give us a comment, the number is 1-800-222-9455 anywhere in the United States, or you can call locally at 333-9455. That's 333-9455. Now, I don't know, is it the Mormon Church that calls the conflicts the wars of Missouri and Utah and Illinois?
Well, actually, there's this sort of lump term of the Mormon Wars in the middle of the 19th century, and, the Church does regard those as wars. I mean, federal government troops were sent against the Church in the 1850s. President Buchanan sent federal troops to Utah because he believed that the territory was in a state of rebellion based on the reports of a limited number of non-Mormon judges. In terms of actual military aggression, skirmishes were fairly limited, but the Mormons felt they were under attack, and in fact, they had federal troops massed on their borders. In Missouri, the only governmentally issued extermination order against a group of United States citizen was issued by, Lieutenant Governor, later Governor of Missouri, Lilburn Boggs, with regard to the Mormons. He essentially said in the 1830s that the Mormons needed to get out or face extermination, and he meant by that that they would kill all members of the Mormon community. And it was in Missouri that an event called the Hans Mill Massacre took place, in which upwards of 20 Mormon men and boys were killed by a mob that attacked the Mormon community at Hans Mill. So there were a series of events and skirmishes throughout the middle of the 19th century, culminating in federal troops being sent to Utah in the 1850s, that have definitely served through the course of Mormon history to make them feel like they've been under attack.
And Joseph Smith's death, can you just explain to us how that took place?
Essentially, Joseph Smith was a very, very powerful man within the Mormon community. He was the first prophet. His followers regarded him as having restored God's true church on earth. And he was also the president of the church, which meant that he administratively and institutionally oversaw the community. And by the time the community moved to Nauvoo, Illinois in the early 1840s, he had become the general of a local militia that the community had a state charter to set up for protection of the community, because, of course, they'd been run out of Missouri very, very violently. And Smith got permission from the government of the state of Illinois to establish a local militia, of which he named himself the general. And then he actually declared that he was going to run for president of the United States. And this kind of blurring of the line between church and state on the part of a religious leader was not well regarded by non-Mormons in the community. The Mormons practiced communitarian values to greater and lesser extent during the 19th century, and so Smith was regarded as having a great deal of economic control over members. And finally, he began inviting other members, higher up members of the church, men specifically, to practice celestial marriage by taking plural wives in Nauvoo in the 1840s. Now, this was not something that he wanted non-Mormons to know about at the time. And it was also not something he was ready to disseminate to the broader membership of the church. The church had over 10,000 members at this point, because he felt that they weren't ready for it and they needed to be introduced to the idea slowly. Now, he did have a biblical precedent for this. You know, he believed he was reestablishing at God's order the practice of plural marriage as it had been practiced by the Israelite patriarchs, specifically, like Abraham and Isaac. But some members of the church, once they found out about the practice, were totally horrified and left the church and then decided to inform the rest of the community. And so a small group printed a newspaper basically outing Smith and the other apostles as having taken plural wives. And Smith's response, which was actually a fairly typical sort of frontier America response, was he sent the militia to tear down the printing press that had produced the newspaper and destroy all copies of the newspaper. As I said, this was not unheard of. In fact, this was something that happened between abolitionists and pro-slavery factions in Missouri during the same years. But what it did in the case of Joseph Smith was it provided the non-Mormon authorities for a cause to take action. And so they declared that he was preventing freedom of speech and freedom of the press, and they arrested him. He was taken to jail in Carthage, Illinois. And after being kept there for some amount of time, the governor of Illinois had been to speak with Smith, and Smith and his associates who were in the jail, some who were being held there with him and some who were there visiting, there was a sort of constant stream of visitors from the Nauvoo community, begged the governor not to leave Smith unprotected and swore that if the governor did not give his personal protection to Smith, that he would be killed by mob violence. The governor said, no, I'm sure you'll be fine. He left. A mob descended, including members of the local militia who were set to guard the jail, and in short, Smith was shot and died in 1844.
We're going to take our first caller now. I'll call her on line 4 from Eureka. You may ask your question.
Yes, thank you. Very interesting program. My thoughts were to when Utah was trying to enter the Union as a state.
Yes.
In the 1870s, 80s, and I believe it was entered somewhere in the 1890s.
Yes.
And this is my understanding of what happened. Maybe you could give me your evaluation that the prophet at that time, the head of the church, suddenly received a revelation about polygamy and stating that Mormons or the LDS church could no longer practice polygamy, plural marriage. And then at that time, the sentiment, the criticism to, or the opposition to entry into the Union evaporated in the Congress of the United States. Was that more or less the story, or is there more to it than that?
Well, there's definitely more to it, although polygamy was definitely of central focus. Polygamy was the issue that got the most attention, but also there were concerns about basically the church hierarchy's control of Utah politically, socially, economically. The church was operating a communitarian territory. People contributed all of their excess goods, agricultural, mercantile, and otherwise, to the community stores, and they were redistributed. Also, the church had a political party at the time, and the church had almost complete control over territorial politics, which is not surprising given the fact that the vast majority of the population at that point were Mormon. There had been a number of efforts starting in the middle of the 19th century in Congress to legislate issues relating to what were seen as Mormon transgressions against American culture. The Republican Party, in fact, was founded in the mid-19th century claiming that it was going to rid the nation of the twin relics of barbarism, slavery and polygamy. And after the Civil War, the nation turned its eyes again to what was going on out in the Intermountain West. So Congress bandied this around for a few decades, really, the issues of political control, economic control, and marriage as they were practiced out in the Latter-day Saint area of the country. And the Latter-day Saints actually fought in the courts to try to maintain their way of life, arguing that they were protected under the First Amendment of the Constitution. And finally, the Supreme Court ruled against them and said that what you believe is one thing, but how you act is another thing entirely. And we are going to legislate to control your actions, and that's perfectly within the bounds of the Constitution. So arguments about the correctness of the Supreme Court ruling aside, the church was put in the position of either giving in to the United States government effectively or being dissolved. I mean, legislation had actually taken away the church's property. It disenfranchised or took the vote away from any Mormon who would not swear an oath against polygamy. And so it was really a matter of survival to some extent. And so in 1890, Wilson Woodruff, who was then the prophet of the church, announced that he had received a revelation that, amongst other things, ended the practice of celestial marriage. And the church dissolved their political party. They gave over control of the local school system, which they controlled up until that time because they created it when they got to this uninhabited place. You know, one of the first things the church did was set up schools. But they handed over the schools to the territorial government, and in 1896 they were admitted as a state.
You're listening to Keeping the Faith. We're talking about Mormons and anti-Mormon sentiment in America. Our guest is Christine Hutchinson-Jones, a PhD candidate from Boston University. If you're listening and would like to ask a question, you can call at 1-800-222-9455 or locally at 333-9455. We're going to go with line one. You may ask your question.
Hello, I have a question. I didn't hear the very beginning of the show, and I understand that your guest is a PhD candidate there at BU, but I would like to know what her own personal interests and affiliations are. This is a very interesting topic, and it's certainly an important one since we have had a presidential candidate representing this group. So just fill us in a little bit on your background, and that'll give us a sense of where you started from. Thanks so much. I'm going to hang up and listen.
Okay. I actually have a bachelor's degree from Florida State University in American Studies and Religion, and I'm very interested in the role that religion has had to play in shaping American culture. And after I began my graduate studies, I became particularly interested in the history of Christianity in the United States and in the history of religious intolerance in this country. We often recognize ourselves as being this wonderfully diverse and tolerant society, which we are, but there's also this very long history of religious intolerance. I began by examining the history of anti-Catholicism, which dates back essentially to the first colonial, the founding of the first colonies. Anti-Catholicism was really imported from Protestant Europe, and as the colonies and then the nation grew, a dominant Protestant majority really set the tone for what was appropriate religion in the United States. And so groups that did not fit into those sort of religious cultural norms as seen by the Protestant mainline majority faced a certain amount of intolerance. This includes Quakers, Shaker community, which no longer exists which is actually very, very limited. They only have a few dozen members at this point. Jews, Catholics, and I became interested in Mormons because I was looking for a dissertation topic. I was casting around, and I had looked at the issue of anti-Mormonism in the United States. And what's very interesting about Mormonism is because it was founded in the United States, some would call it the quintessentially American religion, and because its history is so well documented, for the purposes of a PhD student, it's fantastic because it's very easy to follow the church's growth and changing attitudes among Americans towards the Latter-day Saints.
All right, we're going to go with our caller on line two. Let me ask your question.
Yeah, I have two questions for you. One is, I have to say, you did not really address the previous caller. The basic question, are you a Mormon yourself or are Latter-day Saints, whichever name you prefer? Because clearly, at the best, you're a supporter, and at the worst, you're an apologist. It's very clear in your language that you support this religion and that you're trying to be a booster for them. So I'm curious about that. And the second thing is, most of Christianity teaches that people should be humble. So how does that jive with the idea that people who follow this religion call themselves saints? Most people, or I should say most Christians, think that sainthood is something that's reserved for folks who are very, very special and do very, very special acts of good works and so on. You don't have to just show up every Sunday to be called a saint. So I'm kind of curious about, you know, how does that kind of fit together? It just doesn't make a lot of sense to me. So I'll go ahead and listen offline, but I appreciate your time on the show.
Okay. Well, I'm not a Mormon, and I would not say that I'm a booster either. In fact, I'm just very interested in issues of religious freedom in the United States and the ways in which those get played out. And I'm fascinated by the fact that, in spite of the fact that we have enshrined religious freedom in the Constitution, and we are justifiably proud of the fact as a nation that we are incredibly diverse and incredibly tolerant, that unfortunately there are movements of religious intolerance throughout our history. So I wouldn't say that I'm a booster of any particular religion. I'm a booster of religious tolerance. As for the name of the community, Latter-day Saints are expected to be extremely, extremely active in the religious community, and a big part of being a Mormon is outreach, charitable outreach, within the Mormon community and also increasingly throughout the 20th and into the 21st century outside of the community. So you are expected, you know, you don't just join the church and suddenly you're a saint, quote unquote, and your work is done. In order to be part of the community in good standing, there's a great deal of work within the community and also outside of that religious group in terms of charitable outreach in the United States and around the world that is expected of members in order to maintain their status within the community.
You're listening to Keeping the Faith on WILL. Our subject today is Mormons and anti-Mormon sentiment in America. If you'd like to ask a question of our guest, Christine Hutchinson-Jones, a PhD candidate at Boston University, you can call us anywhere in the U.S. at 1-800-222-9455 or locally at 333-9455. That's 333-9455. And Christine, you're talking about Catholicism earlier and anti-Catholicism in America. And how do you think that anti-Catholic rhetoric or any even anti-Semitism in America is related to anti-Mormonism?
Well, I think religious intolerance in the United States often focuses on specific issues surrounding religious behavior. Sex is always an issue. In the early years of the colonies and into the 19th century, the question of celibacy in the Roman Catholic Church, for interest, was a very hot topic. It was definitely not the norm in a Protestant community where even ministers were expected, not just allowed, but expected to be family men. And I use the word men advisedly because, of course, women were largely excluded from the clergy in all religious communities in the United States until the 20th century. And so celibacy was really a sort of transgressive position to take. And, in fact, a lot of anti-Catholic material was a lot of words were spent speculating about whether priests and nuns really were celibate. There were a lot of accusations that, in fact, you know, they weren't really maintaining celibacy and that there was, in fact, a lot of sexual debauchery going on behind the closed doors of the convents. And also control of religious leaders within communities is over the membership of a community is always a major question at issue. In the case of Roman Catholicism, there's the issue of the authority of the priests and the church hierarchy and how much authority they have, some would say unquestioned authority, over membership, both in terms of their religious behavior and also their behavior in the world outside the church doors. And in the case of anti-Semitism, for example, there is no international or even necessarily national Jewish hierarchy that is telling Jewish leaders and Jewish communities exactly how they must behave and how they must be in lockstep with the community on social and political issues particularly. But in fact, in the early 20th century, Henry Ford was responsible for propagating the publication of what turned out to be a false document, the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, which purportedly was a document issued to Jews internationally, telling them how they must behave and also accusing them of being disloyal to their country, whatever country they were resident in, and in fact being Jews before Americans. This is always a concern. Are you Jews first? Are you Americans first? Are you Catholics first? Are you Americans first? Are you Mormons first? Or are you Americans first? And this comes up in presidential politics, as I mentioned before. When John F. Kennedy ran for the presidency, he had to answer questions about whether he was going to be a Catholic first and answer to the Pope, or whether he was going to be an American first and respond to the American people as president of the United States. And Mitt Romney was asked similar questions about his relationship to the Latter-day Saint hierarchy. Was he going to be a Mormon first and respond to the calls of the Mormon prophet and president, or was he going to be the American president and serve the interests of the nation? So this is something that always comes up.
We're going to go ahead and take caller line. Caller on line one from Urbana. Go ahead with your question.
Hi, I don't have a question. I just had a little comment. I am a Mormon, and I just had a comment on the last callers who called in about the calling us ourselves saints, the term saints. And I just wanted to clarify that it might help to understand that we sort of think of the definition of saint as different. To us, being a saint just means being a follower of Jesus Christ. And that's what we believe the term was used more in the Bible in that way. So we don't think that we're better than anybody else. That's just, you know, to us, that's what it means.
Thank you for that.
Not that we're holier than everyone else, or just that we follow Jesus Christ.
Thank you for your comment. And Christine, your dissertation is called Defining America, Reviling and Revering the Mormons, 1890 to 2008. So we've talked a little bit about how Americans revile the Mormons, but how do you think that they revere the Mormons?
Well, especially starting in the middle of the 20th century, the Mormons have been revered for a variety of characteristics that are seen as, you know, a sort of ultra-American. This particularly began with the Great Depression. The community was extraordinarily self-sufficient. Mormons were largely located in the old Deseret in the Intermountain West, primarily centered in Utah. And the community, as it was seen from outside, was largely self-supporting through the Depression. Now, of course, if you look at the facts and figures as kept by, you know, the U.S. government, Mormons were in pretty much the same situation as the rest of the United States in terms of needing assistance from the government and, you know, taking advantage of the various programs that Franklin Delano Roosevelt instituted to bring us out of the Depression. But they already had so many internal structures set up within the church and within the Mormon community that they were able to support one another in ways that some other American groups just simply didn't have the support systems for. And so there began this idea of Mormon self-sufficiency as a community. They also have a stellar record of serving the United States in the military, starting as far back as the Civil War, and this was true also in both world wars, and this was highly reported on and was seen as a sign of their great and deep patriotism, which, of course, is something that we highly value in the United States. And in the later part of the 20th century, they really began to be seen as the model of family values, as defined by the nuclear family, a mother, a father, and children. Mormons place an enormous amount of importance on family life and on having and raising children. And so this has sort of pushed them to the front of being this the idea of the perfect American family.
So the Proposition 8 campaign in California was supported by the Mormon community as well as the evangelical community, the African-American community, and the Latino community, and the Catholic community as well. But why do you think it is that the Mormon community was particularly attacked for supporting that campaign?
Well, they were extraordinarily vocal, and the church did call on its members to support Proposition 8, much like the Catholic Church calls on its members to support pro-life. perspectives. And in fact, the Catholic Church also called on the Catholic Church in America also supported Proposition 8. It is definitely against gay marriage, and evangelical communities did the same. But the Mormons did come out in numbers to work for the passage of Proposition 8, and they've got a highly efficient infrastructure for outreach both within their own community, because they are such a well-organized group with a central leadership, and also because of their missionary efforts. You know, they know how to go door to door, and they know how to do so very, very effectively. And so it was their very efficiency, I think, that sort of put them at the front of everyone's notice. Because when the church told members to mobilize, they did, and they did it well. Also, the fact of the matter is that Mormons are still held suspect in a lot of corners of the American culture. And so when Mormons come out in force in support of something that is as unpopular in many quarters as Proposition 8 was, it draws a lot of notice. And finally, I think that the fact that Mormons are so easy to locate, as it were, we still associate Mormons with Utah, and Utah is in fact still a majority Mormon state, although Mormons are all over the country at this point, we still think of Utah as the Mormon state. It's the location of Mormonism. And so when gay rights organizations called for a response to the passage of Proposition 8, one of the things they called for was a boycott of the state of Utah in response to Mormon support of Proposition 8. And, you know, there's not really as easy a boycott for, say, Catholic support of Proposition 8. You know, what location or what activities, such as, you know, wintertime skiing in Utah and the Sundance Film Festival, could you boycott in response to Catholic support or evangelical support? So because the Mormons are associated with a specific location, they're also, it's sort of easy to pinpoint them as someone that you can respond to.
And some of the people who are upset about the Proposition 8 campaign also used a lot of rhetoric towards the Mormons that called them polygamists and said that they had no right to address the issue of families and marriage because of this. So what do you think that has done to the conversation about gay marriage?
Well, specifically, I think that critics of Mormon support for Proposition 8 point to the church's past as a polygamous tradition and say, well, you know, you've had the experience of practicing a different sexual lifestyle than the majority of Americans and have been persecuted for it, so you shouldn't be persecuting others for unpopular sexual behaviors. And I think that the contemporary church would say, well, we haven't done that in over 100 years. Polygamy is no longer part of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. So they've completely disavowed that part of 19th century Mormon practice. So really, I think they would see the question of their polygamous history as irrelevant because they gave it up. Therefore, it's not something that they can be called on to be sympathetic about because it's no longer part of who they are. And by pointing to that polygamous past and pointing specifically to a past that's truly behind the church, you know, the church can dismiss that argument as irrelevant to who they are and what they're doing now.
You're listening to Keeping the Faith on WILL. If you have a question or a comment, you can call anywhere in the United States at 1-800-222-9455 or locally at 333-9455. That's 333-9455. And can we talk a little bit about the extermination order in
Sure.
Missouri?
Mormons were not popular in Missouri. There's a wide variety of reasons, from the fact that they were considered to be a strange religion with odd theological ideas and strange practices, to the fact that they were perceived, Missouri was a contested territory when it came to the dispute over slavery before the Civil War, and it was largely a slave, the population was largely supportive of slavery, and Mormons were perceived to be against slavery. They were suspected essentially being closet abolitionists because Joseph Smith had said that the Latter-day Saints would welcome all people as members, regardless of color. So he was happy to accept African-American members as well as whites. And this gave the church a reputation as an abolitionist group, even though it did not take a particularly active position on the question of slavery. And also because Mormons as a group in the 19th century were encouraged to gather, if you converted to Mormonism, regardless of where you were, and this meant as far afield as Europe, they were very successful garnering converts in Northern Europe and Great Britain, converts were encouraged to move to where the community was in the United States, and that initially meant Missouri. So there was this constant stream of Mormon converts, and the group grew very, very quickly. They started with 30 members in 1830 when the church was founded, and by the time Joseph Smith died, they were up to over 10,000, and that was, you know, less than 15 years later. And this group was very tight-knit, and economically, they tended to support one another. They, you know, shopped at Mormon businesses. There were rumors that Mormons charged higher prices of non-Mormons than they did of their fellow Mormons. And also they were seen as a threat politically because they were a voting bloc. They largely voted together as a group. And this made communities wherever they ended up, whether it was in Ohio where they started in the early 1830s or in the different areas of Missouri where they lived or finally Illinois, nervous because they were seen, especially as they grew, to have an enormous amount of political power and they really could control local politics and distinctly influence state politics by the time they left Illinois because of their numbers. And so all of these things made them a threat to the non-Mormon community as the non-Mormon community saw it. There were a number of skirmishes between anti-Mormon mobs who were attacking smaller Mormon communities. Several Mormon communities were burned down. Mormons were frequently faced with threats of violence, if not outright violence. As I mentioned, the event called the Hans Mill Massacre happened in Missouri, where several dozen Mormon men and boys were killed by an anti-Mormon mob. And finally, the state government's response when the Mormon community appealed to the state for protection was that the Mormons were bad for keeping the peace, that essentially where you have Mormons, there will be conflict because you're so unpopular, we can't do anything to protect you from the population. And because you are the cause of this disturbance in the peace, you need to get out or we're going to exterminate you. This was the extermination order was officially given by Lieutenant Governor Lilburn Boggs, and it was rescinded by the state of Missouri in the 20th century.
Okay, we're going to go with caller on line one. You may ask your question.
I have a question. You said that the Mormons gave up polygamy in 1890?
Yes, ma'am.
My question is, what happened to the family structure? What happened to all the second, third, and fourth wives? Where was their place in the community after that?
Well, essentially, those people who had already contracted polygamous marriages continued to live those marriages for the most part. Once the official order on the part of the prophet was that they would not, they would no longer enter into new polygamous marriages. And once that concession was made, the United States became less concerned about going after those who were already practicing polygamy. So a lot of the church members who had multiple wives, you know, continued to live with those wives. In some sense, I mean, they didn't always cohabitate. Others were, in some sense, left to fend for themselves, although those numbers are very, very small. And something else that I think should be pointed out is that at no point was a majority of the Mormon community engaged in the practice of plural marriage. Numbers I've seen range from 10 to 15% is the best estimate, that approximately 10 to 15% of Latter-day Saints in the 19th century practiced polygamy, which left, you know, 85 to 90% who were engaged in monogamous marriages. So it wasn't as big a problem as non-Mormons outside the community tended to believe it was. And as I said, also, once the United States had gotten the promise that there would be no new polygamous marriages, they were less concerned about going after those who were already engaged in polygamous marriages.
Okay, we're going to go with caller on line two. You may ask your question.
Yes. I'd like to go back to the comment you made about the reason for the resistance to them in Missouri, mm-hmm. having to do with them being perceived as being abolitionist. I think you said that blacks were welcomed into the Mormon Church at that time.
Yes.
You're the expert on this, but I have a pretty distinct memory that it wasn't until the Civil Rights era that blacks were allowed, and it took a special visit of the prophet at that time with God to get the official teaching changed, that blacks were not welcomed as full members until the last several decades, and that that was a revision of previous treatment of the blacks, that they were not welcomed and they were seen as second class, and that their black skin color was correlated with, you know, being something less than...
Right.
I'm surprised that
they were
perceived as being abolitionist in Missouri at that time.
Right. Well, they welcomed African-American members, but the church is organized in a very hierarchical structure. They don't have paid clergy, and every man eventually can rise to the level of attaining priesthood. But in the 19th century, only white men could attain the priesthood level of membership. Blacks were welcome as members, but they could not be priests. And you're right that it was only after the Civil Rights Movement that that actually changed within the church. It was 1978, actually, that the church prophet received a revelation announcing that all members, white and non-white, could now achieve full priesthood and thereby attain the fullest, you know, membership in the fullest sense. But prior to that, black members were welcome. They were just restricted in how high they could go in church hierarchy. And actually, that the attitude about black skin color was unfortunately a common one in 19th century Christian America. There are innumerable tracts that exist that were written by religious figures in all different Christian denominations, arguing they often focus on the idea that black skin color was the curse of Ham. When God cursed Noah's son Ham in the Bible, that what that curse meant was black skin. And so that was actually an argument that was used in religious circles well beyond Mormonism and throughout Protestant Christian America in a variety of denominations to support both slavery and the second-class citizenship of African Americans. But thankfully, that has, you know, slowly but surely been abandoned, and the Mormon Church was a little bit behind. Many Christian denominations in the United States started ordaining African American members in the 1950s and 60s, if they hadn't already. And as I said, the Mormons extended the priesthood in 1978, but they did do that in 1978, and in fact, their numbers are on the rise in the African-American community.
We have time for just a couple more questions. If you have a question or comment, you can call anywhere in the United States at 1-800-222-9455 or locally at 333-9455. Now, Christine, why do you think it is that people were disturbed by the idea of new scripture in the 19th century?
Well, the New Testament actually explicitly forbids new scriptural revelations, and there are warnings throughout the Christian New Testament against false prophets. So this is what was pointed to. And, you know, you've got to remember that by the early 19th century, when Joseph Smith became active, we hadn't had any new scripture in the Christian community in almost 2,000 years. So this is a pretty big deal. People believed that the Book of Mormon was anti-scriptural in the sense that, you know, the New Testament warned against new scriptures, and also that the Bible in itself was whole and sufficient and complete. And by this I mean the Hebrew Bible or the Old Testament and the Christian New Testament, and that therefore the Book of Mormon couldn't possibly have anything to add. also the story of how Joseph Smith was led to the gold plates by the angel Moroni and how he translated them with divine assistance was seen as preposterous. People argued that there was no way this was true. It has been said that one of the biggest problems that Joseph Smith had was he founded a new religion in a post-Enlightenment age. So after the Enlightenment, when we started to believe that everything should be subject to rigorous questioning and that rational thought processes and, you know, reason should be applied to all things, the idea that this man was talking to God and seeing angels and on the basis of very little education and no ability with foreign languages was translating gold plates that an angel had given to him was seen as simply preposterous.
Okay, we're going to go with caller on line four. You may ask your question.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Uh-huh, go ahead.
No, actually, I had two comments. One is there seem to be some remarkable parallels between the life of Joseph Smith and the development of the Church of Latter-day Saints with the development of Muhammad and Islam. And second, the mobs, I came late, so I may have missed this, but the mobs that drove the Mormons from Missouri, from Illinois, and from their respective places where they attempted to settle, those weren't large collections of secular humanists. What exactly was the religious persuasion of the people who drove the Mormons from the places in which they lived? And what do you think the underlying root cause for that was, if you will? And I'll hang up and listen.
Well, the underlying or root cause for driving the Mormons out of any various community, as I've said, there are multiple reasons, and it's fairly complicated, but they were seen as religiously weird. Their theological beliefs and their idea in ongoing revelation were considered very strange and were considered by many to be inappropriate within a Christian context. And they were also considered a political and an economic threat because they were gathered together in a very insular community, and Mormons supported Mormons, and it was believed that they were hostile to non-Mormons. And as the numbers grew, they were a really powerful voting bloc, especially in these frontier territories where the overall population of a territory was not that large. And socially, you know, it had started to get out, even though they weren't publicly practicing celestial marriage or polygamy at this time. Word had started to spread, and this was seen as a real threat to, you know, essentially the family values of the time and also, you know, good social order. As far as a religious affiliation to the members of these mobs, it wasn't really defined by local religious preference or what religious community people belonged to. It was just groups of local people, regardless of religious affiliation. And in fact, in the frontier communities where Mormons lived in Missouri and Illinois, church attendance was not exactly universal. People didn't necessarily actively participate in a religious community, especially in the frontier. So there it can't be pinpointed as to, you know, what specific religious community was promoting these mobs. It was really just all of the people in a local area because the Mormons were seen as a threat on a variety of fronts.
Okay, and then we're going to go with the caller on line one. You may ask your question.
Hello, can you hear me?
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Hi, I have two questions, actually. They're kind of not related, but kind of related. As far as, is the Mormon church a Christian church? I've been doing some reading up on that, and like most of the Christian churches, like the Catholic Church and the Methodist Church and Protestant churches, say they don't acknowledge Mormon baptism as a valid baptism because they say Mormons don't believe in the Holy Trinity. They believe in something way different, and then that they believe that people can become God. Could you address that issue? And also, I've been doing some reading, and there's been, like in the temples that the Mormons practice in, they had this practice of, like, cutting people's heads off if they were to reveal what's going on in that particular temple practice. Could you also talk a little bit about that as well? Thank you.
Okay, as far as the question of whether or not Mormons are Christian, you know, that's disputed. Mormons would say we are absolutely Christians. We call ourselves the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints because we believe in Jesus Christ as the Savior of humankind. Many Christian communities that existed and before the Mormons did would say no, they're not, because their beliefs are distinctly different enough from historical Christianity as it developed over the 1800 years prior to the founding of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, that those other communities would say that no, they're not. Their beliefs are different enough that they shouldn't be called Christians. So the Mormons would say yes, and a lot of non-Mormons would say no. As for cutting off people's heads in the temples, you know, what goes on in the temples, the various rituals, they're closely guarded secrets. They're only Mormons in good standing are allowed inside the temples to participate in these rituals. But there were a number of practices in which people were bound to maintain the secrecy of what went on in the temple. And reportedly, when people took these vows prior to, I believe, the early 1990s, they would make the sign of cutting their throat as a sign of basically the seriousness. You know, if I don't keep these secrets, you know, essentially may the greatest punishment available come down on me. But this is not saying that Mormons were going to enforce some sort of death order on people who don't keep the secrets of what goes on inside the temple. In fact, the reason that as many people know anything about temple rituals as do is because many people who have left the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints have written extensively about the temple rituals that they participated in, including this vow of secrecy. But the temple rituals were changed in the early 1990s, and I believe that the symbolic slitting of the throat is one of the things that was abandoned.
Okay, we have just 2 minutes left in the show, so we're going to take one quick question from caller on line two. Caller on line two.
I was wondering about the how tightly, like, everyday Mormons may be tied to the leadership of the prophet, because there's some, like, everyday Catholics that don't necessarily follow every edict of the Pope.
Right. Well, there's diversity in Mormonism like there is in any other religion. They are perceived to be very conservative politically and socially. But in fact, one of the things that has gotten a lot of attention recently because of Proposition 8 is the fact that there were quite a few Mormons, especially visible on the Internet, because there were Mormon groups on the Internet that opposed Proposition 8. So there's a great deal of political diversity within the church. And in fact, one of the things that I've even had pointed out to me by a Latter-day Saint missionary in my own neighborhood in Boston, Massachusetts recently is that Harry Reid, the Democratic leader of the United States Senate, is in fact a Mormon. So just like any other religious community, you will find a diversity of beliefs both religiously and politically. And you will find some people who are less, not as in lockstep with the leadership as some other members. And I think the American Catholic example is a good one.
Well, thank you so much, Christine, for talking to us on this very interesting topic of Mormons and anti-Mormon sentiment. You've been listening to Keeping the Faith on WILL. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Keepin' the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
Keepin' the Faith is made possible in part by the Quaker Meeting of Champaign-Urbana, a local community dedicated to the Quakers' testimony of peace, equality, integrity, and simplicity. The weekly meeting includes silent worship Sunday mornings at 10:30 a.m. at 1904 East Main Street in Urbana. Online at quaker.org/urbana.
much do you know about the place where you live? Well, you probably know your neighbors, your schools, the grocery store. But can you describe what your neighborhood looked like before there were houses in it? How much local history can you tell? I'm Jim Fleming. Next time on To the Best of Our Knowledge, Constructing a Sense of Place. It's To the Best